Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick with this week's By the Numbers with co-host Dan Reese. Dan, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Not the result we hoped for, but still a hard-fought game by the Ravens. So that was good to see, but disappointing finish, I guess. So.
Yeah, good playoff football. Obviously, the Ravens have had some ups and downs in terms of truly high leverage plays in NFL history. We'll get into that in this episode because that's what we do. But thinking back to the block field goal in return in 2000 was a kind of a similar high leverage play, and this was off the charts in terms of what happened in this game. But Dan, always a pleasure to do this with you. Want to thank our sponsor, Liquid Death, the water that will brutally murder your thirst. Please give their product a try. They've been very good to us. I think I'll start off this week, Dan, and start with the numbers of 3.15, 2.38, 58.6%, and 71.9%. 3.15 was the average time to throw for Tyler Huntley, who held the ball for longer this week and was one of the fourth longest of 12 wild card quarterbacks. Whereas on the other side of the coin, 2.38, the average time for Joe Burrow, was the quickest getting the ball out in the entire NFL. Now, obviously, we've been over this before, but there are pluses and minuses. It's not just a good stat always to get rid of the ball late, but generally speaking, Lamar Jackson is better when he throws the ball late. Tom Brady and Joe Burrow are probably better when they throw the ball early and they hit their targets and they allow for some yak on the plays. Huntley, a 58.6% completion percentage, that was ninth best in the NFL of 12 quarterbacks. 66.6%, so he was 8 points worse. 66.6% was as expected, and he fell short of that by 8 points. Burrow, a 71.9% completion rate, and he fell short of his expected of 75.5%. So a lot of quicker throws for Burrow. Burrow certainly made more out of his throwing opportunities in some ways in terms of completion percentage, but not in terms of yards per play, where the Ravens had 6.7 and the Bengals had only 5.1 yards per play. Definitely a game where when the Bengals were moving the ball, they moved it methodically down the field with the passing game, did not really try and hand the game over to their running backs, which for the second consecutive week didn't really work against the Ravens.
Yeah, it was an interesting approach, and I think the Ravens did a pretty good job on defense, shutting it down or at least limiting it. I think if you saw or were told that the Bengals would throw for 5.1 yards per game, I think you would take that going into it. The time to throw with it being the fastest, I still thought the Ravens did a pretty good job of getting pressure occasionally. So that was nice because oftentimes with that fast of a release, you don't get any pressure all game. So,
right. Yeah, very, very much true. They got more pressures that they gave up ample time and spaces. I think it was 13-7 in this game as I scored it. So very, very nice to see that in a game like this.
All right, my first set of numbers is 89% and 1. 89% was the percentage of Cincinnati snaps that were from 11 personnel. So as we had kind of expected, seeing what they had done previously against the Ravens and also against, throughout the season, they were heavy 11 personnel. 51 out of 57 snaps is what I had. And on Baltimore's defense, only one of those snaps did they have six DBs on the field. So they were almost entirely in some variation of nickel defense to shut down the 11 personnel. The ability to shut down Cincinnati's three strong wide receiver weapons with just nickel, I thought was really impressive. It allows them to really hold strong against the run as well and just kind of be a balanced defense. Just kind of for perspective, a little bit over 15% of 11 personnel snaps were covered by six plus DBs for the whole NFL season. So, you know, one out of 51 versus 15%. So, you know, so it was good to see that they were able to use their nickel package and really limit a really dynamic passing offense, I thought.
Yeah, it definitely speaks to the kind of game that Kyle Hamilton had, because he was outstanding playing slot corner every one of those snaps, every one of those nickel snaps. Anyway, excuse me. Where that I think did leave the Ravens a little short was on third down, and in particular in some third and longer situations where they did convert some. They were 7 out of 13 on third down, which is a place where the Ravens had been very effective before. It left them not in the greatest position to defend that, because after you get out of a fairly short area, then Hamilton is challenged. And of course they depend more on their linebackers to cover under the circumstances, which is either Roquan or Queen is not going to be as good as a dime back in terms of coverage, as good as Roquan has been so far this year. So yeah, I'm surprised to hear that 15% is the NFL number, because what that tells me is about almost half the teams are committed nickel teams, because normally in a year I'd see about 28-30% dime snaps from the Ravens might be normal. And those include most end of half plays, and really all third down and medium or longer where the opponent goes to 11 or lighter. So that I think is a little surprising. And last point I want to make on this, because this just is obviously, you got the most interesting number of the whole day here. The Bengals didn't really go to 10% on this game, did they? Didn't even have a single snap of 10?
I don't believe so. There were only six snaps other than 11. So, I don't think there was, if so, it was like one or two. So,
right. And so that would have been a way we would have feared might have really challenged the Ravens, because their next cornerback was pretty bad. You know, that they had to bring in. It might have been Ardarius Washington or I guess it was Worley who saw time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. All right. You're up.
All right. Let's go to 15. Is my next number. Just a simple one number. We don't do that too often. That's the number of consecutive games the Ravens have gone without even a 50% red zone percentage, including the wild card game. Now, there's a lot of times where, you know, first of all, the league average is 54.8%. That's actually the median, not the average. I want to be careful about that, but 54.8%. So if you can't even reach 50%, and these are small, discrete numbers, we're talking about, you know, two occurrences, four occurrences is a common number of red zone trips per game. And they don't even have one instance of going 1-for-2 or 2-for-4 during that entire time. That's pretty freaking amazing, frankly. They don't have a single 50% time. They were 5-for-5 in week 3 against New England. That's the last time they topped it. 20 of 53 since, 37.7%. Worst in the league was New England at 42.2% for the season. So it's an area where the team, I think, drastically needs to improve next year.
Yeah, those are unbelievable stats, and in the worst way. You know, I think some of it can be, you know, attributed to Lamar missing some games, but that streak goes way before that. So
okay, I have to correct myself on something. Yeah. They were not over 50% that whole time. I looked at it myself and I'm seeing 20 of 53. That can't be, but they were at 50% exactly several times, but they didn't have had a game where they were 1-for-1 or 2-for-3 or anything like that during the entire time. Just a truly awful run.
Yeah. I think that was, my guess is that was a significant part of the, you know, Roman decision that we saw today. So, I think it definitely will be an area of focus for the new OC that comes in, figuring out a way to. There's no reason that it should be that bad. They have the weapons both in the run game and the big-bodied receivers with the tight ends that they should be able to, you know, take advantage of that area.
So. Yeah, and they have the ultimate weapon is Lamar Jackson, his ability to move laterally and find an open receiver, and that was, you know, big strength of Lamar early in his careers.
You may see your coworkers cracking open a can in your 9 a.m. stand-up meeting, but it's most likely not beer. It's a New Mountain spring water called Liquid Death. You've heard me talk about this many times. Why is it called Liquid Death? Well, because it'll brutally murder your thirst. Plus, its infinitely recyclable tallboy cans are helping to bring a death to plastic bottles. Did you know plastic's not even really recyclable anymore? it ends up just going to a landfill because it's not profitable to recycle. Meanwhile, aluminum is recyclable and profitable for recycling facilities. You guys know how much I love Liquid Death. It's in everything I do. I take it to work. I take it to the ball club. I take it when I'm out with the kids. I got them right here on my desk because I'm recording a podcast. I'm always with it. What's cool now is I'm seeing you guys on Twitter talk about how you're grabbing your cans and going to work. So send me those stories about what you're doing and how you're cracking open a tall boy in odd situations because, hey, it's water. And not only is it water, it's the best water that you can go out there and buy. It's cold. You can drink it with whatever you're doing. So going out there, get Liquid Death at your local Harris Teeter or 7-Eleven, or find a Liquid Death retailer near you with their store locator tool by going to liquiddeath.com/filmstudy. That's liquiddeath.com/filmstudy.
In his career, was not throwing red zone interceptions. So yeah. Anyway.
Yep, absolutely. All right. My next numbers were 314. 12 and 19. So 3:14 was the time left when the Ravens got the ball on the Cincinnati 46 for the last drive. They after they got the ball, they had 12 snaps, including two penalties. They were able to gain only 19 yards. They had seven snaps in the first 160 seconds. And then five snaps in the last 34 seconds. Based on the model I was looking at, they had a 45% chance of scoring a touchdown when they had the ball on the 17-yard line, first and 10 on the 17-yard line with 34 seconds to go with two timeouts. So, you know, all things considered, getting the ball on the 46 with 3:14 left is a pretty darn good spot. Like, I was amazed that they got one final chance there, and I wasn't without a decent level of confidence that they could knock it in. And they moved the ball and got the ball to the 17 with 34 seconds. And it was just too bad that they weren't able to finish the drive, but kind of puts the whole season, this red zone struggles into sums it all up right there. It just was such a weird drive with, you know, how they managed it and how they really finished off there with the final push. So
yeah, it was especially bad to me at like one point, and that was between a minute and I think 34 seconds. They mm-hmm. burned off a lot of time by huddling. Right in there. And I was really liking the time management to that point. I thought, you know, they better score and not leave very much time on the clock, get this game to overtime and not give Burrow, say, 45 seconds to turn it around and score. In fact, there might even be a point, and probably not, but there might even be a point where they get so close to scoring that Cincinnati really wants them to score on the next play kind of thing, because it's a higher probability. But then they got it down to 34 seconds. It was already too low. And then they got the penalty on Zeitler for holding, which backed him up into that second and 20 situation instead of a 4-yard gain. And that really hurt. Then they were out of sorts in terms of being behind the down and distance sticks. They had both timeouts, but they, from that point forward, I think the last four passes he threw were incomplete. So that series, they got themselves off the field that way.
Yeah. I think, you know, if it weren't for the hold, I think 34 seconds could have been enough time. They were able to complete five plays from the 17-yard line. So you would think that would be enough. It was just the result of one of them was a 10-yard loss, and the other four were all 0 yards. So, you know, I think they could have left more time before the 34 seconds, but I didn't mind it terribly. Considering they were still able to get five plays, and they could have done anything. They had their timeouts. So those five plays could have been any type they wanted, basically. So, mm-hmm.
Boy, it would have been great if Prochet could have hauled that ball in. It would have changed everything about his season, about, you know, the trip there, the cold, the memory of the fumble and return. I mean, all of that would have kind of been washed away by potentially. Mm-hmm. Needed overtime score as well by a play like that.
Yep, game of inches for sure, as they say. So,
All right. 4-3-2. So Lamar Jackson has led the Ravens in rushing for four consecutive years now. It happened again in 2022. So 19 through 22, he's been the leader each year. He is now third all time on the Ravens rushing list with 4,437 yards. Lewis has 7,801. Rice, 6,180. So those are the only guys ahead of him. Still amazing to me. And he's second now in fumbles all time for the Ravens with 42. You could probably know because you see my sheet here, but Flacco has 80 fumbles, which Lamar might not get to even if he plays the next contract here. He might have to play longer than that. But the number three guy I found to be kind of interesting, Kyle Bowler with 36 fumbles. And I know there's some younger fans we have who really didn't get to see too much of Kyle Bowler playing, or if they did, it's when he was very young. But one of the things Bowler had a lot of trouble with is getting away from center cleanly. The left guard or the center would step on his foot a lot. Mike Flynn, I always make fun of the Ravens' footwork at center from that era because it was terrible relative to what it is today. It's much better coached. Would step on Bowler's foot a lot. But the other thing Bowler would do is just be moving around the pocket and lose the ball off his knee with some regularity. And just it's mind-boggling to watch the guy play football. It's like, how did this guy ever get the quarterback position when he's constantly acting like a spaz with the football here anyway?
Yeah, that's too funny with Bowler. But you know, Lamar leading for a fourth consecutive season, it's pretty crazy. Basically four out of four for all his full seasons. That's pretty amazing. Some of it is, I guess, a little bit splitting with the running back, the running backs kind of by committee. But that's pretty amazing, and it'll be interesting to see what he can do on the all-time rushing list if he's able to get a second contract. So that's definitely pretty amazing, and it'll be interesting to see if that trend continues with the second contract or not, or if he kind of continues to push a little bit further and further away from the designed runs. So. Mm-hmm. All right. My third set of numbers is 4.39, 4.02, and 4.93. These were the yards per snap by Cincinnati in the three matchups versus Baltimore. 4.39 was in this last game in the wild card game, 4.02 in week 18, and 4.93 in week 5. Having sub 5 yards per snap is very good, especially against an offense like Cincinnati. Cincinnati had only 7 total games this season where they were held under 5 yards per play, and the Ravens accounted for 3 of those. So that's pretty impressive. Across the league, the average yards per play is 5.47. So that shows, how impressive it is to hold them below 5. In all 3 games, Baltimore held Cincinnati under 5 yards per drop back snap, and they only had 6 of those games. So half of them under 5 yards were against Baltimore, and it's just amazing to see what Baltimore was able to do this year against a powerhouse offense with Cincinnati and how they were able to shut them down. And it's really just it's really encouraging for next year and the years to come. Because Burrow and those weapons aren't going anywhere, so being able to limit them and to see what the Ravens defense was able to do was really encouraging, I thought.
Yeah, 2 things about that. I think that Cincinnati, one of their offseason priorities is going to be to rebuild the offensive line in a big way. They already did it this last year and it didn't really work out, but I think they'll try again to spend some more money on the offensive line. The second thing is those 3 numbers, 439, 402, and 493, the 2000 Ravens held all opponents to 4.3 yards per play, which is credit to 2000 Ravens, certainly, but gives you a context for how good these numbers were against the Bengals this year. So really remarkable year for the Ravens in these 3 games against Cincinnati. All right, let's move on to the next one, which is, let's do 14.3%. The Ravens had the 6th highest DVOA in the wild card round, which was 14.3%. That broke down as -7.5% on offense. That was 9th out of 12. So minus is bad on offense, but it's good on defense where they were -13.5%. which is fifth in the league. So again, relating that to the low Cincinnati numbers, they really did play pretty well, as DeVoe would indicate in terms of the winning on a play-by-play basis. And this is something I wouldn't have guessed, but they were 8.3% on special teams. I'm trying to think of what special teams plays did they really win? Do they have a big long return at anything? I don't think so. And punts?
Field goals? I can't really think of much. I feel like one return was to like maybe the 30. I can't think of it beyond that. Field goals, I can't really think of whether they were long.
They didn't get penalized on special teams, I don't think. It's surprising to me that it was so good. But anyway, it was the second best of the group. So the point being that their overall DeVoe of 14.3% is outstanding. In fact, they were the only team to lose despite a positive DeVoe in the wild card round. So Jacksonville won at like minus 14% or something, for example. Cincinnati had a DeVoe of 20.8%. So you can see this isn't a zero-sum game, but it still, this is a game where I think it is fair to say both teams played pretty well. The Ravens certainly played well enough defensively, and Cincinnati certainly had enough big plays, unfortunately, to get it done as well.
Yeah, you could definitely see, you know, either team could have ended up as a winner in the game, and you can see that with the DeVoe. I wonder with the special teams if the lack of a negative play is enough on special teams to kind of come out a winner. I wonder. You see like Dallas with the, what was it, 4 missed extra points or something like that. So, you know, but that's, you know, that's really interesting to see. You know, I thought they did do a pretty solid job overall in the game, and, you know, struggled some on offense, but that's to be expected given where they, you know, where they stood personnel wise. So, all right. My next number is 0.114. So that was the EPA on offensive snaps, excluding the fumble. So, which just completely skews all EPA numbers. So, 0.114 was the highest EPA in any of the games without Lamar by a wide margin. But other than that, it was Week 14 with 0.05, so half as much. And it was the fifth highest EPA overall this season for Baltimore. So pretty impressive. They had a 0.07 EPA on pass plays and a 0.14 EPA on run plays. So a pretty solid performance both in run and pass on the offense. And again, especially considering where they were personnel wise and against a pretty decent defense in Cincinnati. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to take the compliment to what you just said. It's also kind of the compliment in terms of how we talk about EPA and WPA models. You know, expected points models are good in the NFL, and they're usually the gold standard because they're more easily measured, I think, and more uniformly measured. But win probability models are what most decisions have to be based on, particularly late in a football game. And if teams make a lot of negative EPA decisions, typically, that are positive win probability decisions, particularly in the fourth quarter. So I'm always a big proponent of win probability. Anyway, per ESPN, the Ravens had a 69% chance to win prior to Huntley's fumble. When Huntley fumbled the ball and it got returned, their win probability dropped to 14%. So a 55% downtick, 55 percentage point downtick. It's actually, they had what, a fifth the chance to win the game after the play as they did before it, you know, and if you want to talk that. Had this occurred in the Super Bowl, it would have been the fourth largest ever swing in winning percentage behind Malcolm Butler's interception in Super Bowl 49. People remember that, right at the goal line, end of the game, Marshawn Lynch should have been running the ball. You know, you remember the play.
Yep.
Number two, Scott Norwood missing wide right from 47 yards to Super Bowl 25. Be from your youth, right? I'm guessing.
I remember that one.
Damn it.
I don't know what year it is, but it's before I remember, at least.
Yeah, it would have been about 91, I think. It was against the Giants. So anyway, 92, the game was played, I think. And then Eli Manning to Plaxico Burress, which is a touchdown I honestly remember all that well. That was the Super Bowl winning touchdown in Super Bowl 42. So anyway, nothing like it, really. And if you look at the first 24 Super Bowls, the games were not generally close, and particularly all the Super Bowls through the end of the 1970s, The biggest ever win probability play was Rick Volk's interception in Super Bowl V. Old Colts fans will remember it. If you're a new fan and you're like Dan, and you say, "Oh, talk about how young you are," then you're out of this conversation. Anyway, really incredible play. It's one of these ones that will that the Ravens will carry like a millstone around themselves. It's not good. They're not going to get rid of it until they have the season that turns it around. Obviously, the 2017 season stuck with the Ravens until Mosley's interception, at least in 2018. Sent him to the playoffs and a division title.
Yeah, it's just it was just an amazing play in the worst possible way. Very reminiscent of the interception in what was it 2 years ago against Buffalo. But man, everything had to go wrong, right? The fumble dropped right into his hands. Mm-hmm. Like a fumble would have been bad, on the goal line, but right into his hands for a return. Was there a, I don't know when it was, but I feel like, was there a Cleveland game where Lamar reached over and got it punched out, but I think they blew a whistle on the return
and kind of
called the play dead. If I remember that correctly. So it's weird that we have two of those reach over the goal line plays for fumbles. So but what a terrible turn of events. It was just by every model, the huge swing in win probability, the EPA on that play, it's just pretty amazing.
Awful way to end the season.
Yeah, it really was. I thought it was interesting though that despite that, they were still able to have a couple of chances. They we talked about before with the first and 10 from the 17, they actually were able to get there by a different model, but than ESPN's, but by the model I was looking at, they were able to get their win probability back up to 23.1%. So the fact that they were able to still have a decent chance of winning was pretty impressive. So one of the models I was looking at had that the play had a negative 12.6 EPA, so which can be expected because they were almost going to score and the other team scored 7. So the model had said that they had a 77% chance that the Ravens would be the next score with a touchdown right there, and only a 3% chance that the next score would be a touchdown by Cincinnati. So pretty crazy by all metrics of that you can look at that play to see the turn of events on that play. So it's really interesting to hear about how how there are other big plays in the Super Bowl, but it's got to be one of the biggest in all of the playoffs, I would think, combined. So I was really impressed by the Ravens that they were able to be in such a strong position right at the goal line there, having a 69% chance to win in this game, I thought was extremely impressive. So, so it was a great spot to be in, but an unfortunate turn of events. So, yeah. All right. My last set of numbers, 4.8 and 3.3. So comparing JK and Gus's performance in week 19, I know there was a little bit of, for week 19, the wild card games. There's a little bit of discussion about that with some of JK's comments. So I wanted to throw put some numbers around this discussion. So 4.8 was the yards per rush for JK compared to 3.3 yards per rush for Gus. So just on a yards per run basis, JK looked a lot stronger on his 13 runs compared to Gus's 12. However, if you dive into kind of the situations and some of the kind of quote unquote analytics numbers, it kind of paints a little bit different picture. The rush yards over expected for JK was actually negative 0.2 compared to Gus of 0.3. The rush yards over expected percentage, so the percentage of plays when the rush yards over expected was positive, was only 31% of the time for JK. So less than a third of his runs were over expected yards versus Gus, 50%. EPA per play, JK averaged negative 0.06 compared to Gus 0.11. A lot of the differences was the kind of the defense that they faced, likely, or a lot of it driven by downs and distance when they were in. But JK faced 8+ defenders in the box on 15% of his rush attempts versus Gus was 42%. So he faced the heavy box a lot. Out of JK's 13 runs, 10 of them were on first and 10. So it was really an interesting usage for hit run. His run plays were really primarily first and 10. And, Gus got the shorter yardage, kind of more obvious run situations. So, there are different types of backs and that kind of aligns with the kind of the roles. But I think basically to kind of summarize, I'm not sure it's as easy as just looking at the yards to decide who had a better performance in this game and who was the stronger running back. But I think it's a really difficult job to balance the attempts for JK and Gus. It's not like it's a one and a two, it's kind of like a 1A, 1B sort of deal. So, I think that'll be interesting to see what happens in the offseason with Gus has a little bit larger contract. And I think it'll be an interesting decision for the new offensive coordinator on how he kind of deploys these two running backs.
Yeah, those are fantastic numbers, by the way. It was I very surprising to me personally. I had not seen them yet, and that's they're great. Just shocking that it is so context-based. Because one thing we've talked about in recent weeks about some of JK's runs is that he's still leaving a lot of yards on the field, particularly in level three. They've done a really good job in the first 10 yards, maximizing those yards, kind of relative to opportunities he had, but not so great after that. I think this really nails it in terms of a lot of this, because another good rushing day. But boy, if this was Gus's last game in a Ravens uniform, been one of the most consistent running backs of all time. In all four of his first 4 years that he actually played, he had a yards per rush of 5.0 or higher, all between 5.0 and 5.3. Just who would have guessed this UDFA back out of Rutgers would be a guy who would come on and be the such a workhorse for the Ravens offense.
Yep, absolutely. And almost always positive yards too, which is so key for this rush offense. So he's been such a good fit. That being said, I think it will be a tough decision on him for this offseason. So
yeah. Yep. $4.4 million cap savings there. So definitely a possibility. We've got one more number to kind of discuss, and we've been having some Lamar numbers recently. The press conference was earlier today. This not sure exactly when this pod is going to post, but talk was getting rid of Greg Roman, of course, which they didn't spend a lot of time on, just a respectful goodbye, as it should be. He's been a very effective offensive coordinator in Ravens history. And then on to Lamar Jackson's contract, which they got a lot of questions about, DaCosta and Harbaugh. And, asked about various things, most centrally the confidence that they'd be able to get a deal done. So I know that there has been wagering out there, and we saw a number, I believe, while we were on BTN last week, while we were recording it, that I saw plus 500 was offered from somewhere, or it might have just been projected. It's easier to project odds when you don't have to back them up. Let's put it that way. If you actually have to bet, then it means something. But recently, last night, I believe, I checked it, and it was minus 200 for Jackson to be a Raven for 2023, which means two-thirds of the time he's there and one-third of the time he's not, if it's a fair bet, which it isn't, because there's some house juice in there. So what I wanted to do with you is handicap it a little more closely, you and me. What's your probability that Jackson will be back for 2023?
I think it's I think it's pretty close to a 50-50. I think I would go a little bit less than 50%. I'm going with a 40% chance that he is back. So
okay, so that means essentially they can't get a deal done. They trade him, and
he's tag and trade is my guess. You know,
yeah.
I don't think there's really another option. I guess theoretically they could keep him 1 year under the tag. I sincerely hope they do not do that approach. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything to gain from doing that. I don't think you learn anything. I don't think you're going to improve the discussion and the decisions long term. I just think decide one way or another this offseason. So
they have done that at least once before, maybe twice, but they did it with Terrell Suggs to keep him under the tag twice before they were able then to sign him. So it's not unprecedented. It can happen. But anyway, I'm with you. I think,
yeah, but not for $45 million. That's a big difference. So
$45 million plus all the draft capital difference between being this year as opposed to next year. So obviously that would be a big difference. Mm-hmm. I'm a little more optimistic about it. I would say 62 to 63% chance he's a Raven in 2023, which means they doesn't mean 100% of that they get a deal done, but certainly most of that they get a deal done. I maybe put it as 55-56% that they get a deal done, the rest of it that he plays under the tag. And I really hope that it is either he plays with a new contract or he's traded. I think those are the two that really make sense for the Ravens. And I think we can agree on that for sure.
Yep, absolutely. And he's such a dynamic weapon. I would love for him to be back, but I just think a lot of events and things that happen this year that will, I guess it'll be an interesting few weeks, I guess, after a month or so, we'll see how it goes.
Dan, I've thoroughly enjoyed doing this show with you all season, and this will be our last show of the year, but tell folks where they can find you online and talk football with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Over on Twitter is the best place, at DP Reese, and then the number 8. During the off season, I'll be, talking about a lot of the, contracts and roster dynamics and all sorts of things like that, and then stuff around the draft too. So, definitely reach out with any questions. Happy to discuss, anything cap related, Ravens related, whatever. So.
All right. Outstanding. Other folks out there, you may have heard it by now, but I'm doing a series called That One Play Now. Please. If you have a play in Ravens history that means something special to you, it could be for historic purposes, because you were there, you think it's the springboard to something in Ravens history, whatever kind of attitude you have towards it, whatever kind of direction you want to come at that play, love to do a show with you. It's short content, 15 to 20 minutes, just on that one particular play. So we'll do a little bit of history, a little bit of description of the play, a little bit of why it's important, a little bit of why it's important to you personally, and then we'll be done. So it's not a difficult barrier to entry, and hopes of new people will get to the microphone and enjoy this as an opportunity. You can DM me on Twitter. They're always open. Dan, great doing this with you this season again.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.